Okay. One of the things that we looked at last weekend was this whole issue of what's happened to the imagination and the reason why, lots of reasons why, in a way, that it's difficult to kind of trust these intuitive, less cognitive processes. And in part as well, we looked at the idea of the colonization of the imagination by advertising, by industry, by commercialism. And oddly enough, with this whole Christmas thing, we have both, in a way, what's interesting about Christmas is we have, as I was saying, we have both these energies around, both that sense of genuine magic and connection with something, and also the sense that of trash or dross or things that we don't like, or a feeling that in a way that there's something going on that's not quite okay. And as I was saying earlier, that's summed up for me in some ways in this image of Santa Claus, you know, who is this. Originally, this powerful forest spirit, a midwinter spirit. And the interesting thing about midwinter, the interesting thing about this time of the year, is, as Susie was saying and is sharing, it's the time when the tide turns. And we enter more and more deeply into the darkness, and then at the darkest point something starts to shift. And we have this image of the Christian image, but it's based on a much older image of the child born in the deepest time of the year. Darkest time of the year. So the spark of light starts to return. And it's a powerful thing in a way. It's an image of, if we really look at that image and get interested in it. You know, the child who is the child of light isn't born at the bright time of the year, it's born at the darkest time. At the time when things are most shutting down, the coldest, the most difficult. So in a way it represents the part of human experience, that paradoxical place where the light is found in darkness. And the new cycle is founded on the death of the old. So one of the things one of the difficult things about the global warming, one of the energy of coldness, of course, is really at winter is really important. Normally, it kills bacteria. It clears the ground. You know, there's something about the dying off process that happens in winter. That the earth needs, and that we all need. And there's something about that astringent energy of winter, where you go back to the bones of things. If you look out over a winter landscape, you know, you've got the skeletons of trees, you've got the sort of the dead grass, but the ground is cleared somewhere. Phrase from Tennyson that always comes to me in connection with this, and who talks about it's in the Mort d'Arthur where he's talking about the end of the table and the destruction of the fellowship, and and he's talking about the necessity for this, and he uses this interesting phrase, the necessity of this, lest one good custom should corrupt the world. And in a way, what he's pointing to, and what a lot of these old stories and ideas are pointing to, is the fact that we live in a dynamic, moving universe, and even something that is good, if it is maintained beyond its time, it starts to corrupt the world. Because it stops, it becomes static, and in becoming static, it loses its life energy. It then becomes repetitive. And part of what we have to deal with in all this, in all these processes, is the wish, and the natural wish in a way, but the difficult wish, to keep things as they are, to hang on to the good that we know. And the problem with the good that we know is that if we try to hang on to it, something happens to us. We start to contract. And one of the difficult, actually one of the edges, is things about one that has to be careful, or maybe I in particular have to be careful about as I get older, is that sense of I've seen it all before and know it all before, and I know what I like and I know what I don't like. And if you get too caught in that, you of course just repeat yourself. You just keep, you don't change, you just keep repeating an image of yourself. And you know, obviously, it's one of the things about experience, life is you learn things about yourself, and it's good to know those things. But also, there's this real need, I think, important need, to retain openness to the mystery and to change. And if you're going to do that, it means you have to keep on revisiting winter. Because we could say the world of advertising is presented as is a world of eternal summer, or spring and summer. Autumn and winter don't ever really get depicted there. You know, if we were an alien looking at TV advertising to try and get an understanding of what human beings look like. But human beings are always very young and beautiful. Very occasionally you see some older people on TV, but they're always really quite good looking and quite glossy looking. And people live in a world where everything is very shiny and new, and nothing wears out. So it really is that sense of the world of blossom and germination and blossoming. A world actually without fruit. Because in autumn, things we receive the fruit of things. And in a certain sense, as you get older, you start to receive the fruit of your life. I had a whole period of my life working with older people one time. You know, I mean, people in their 80s and 90s and sort of. And it's probably an overgeneralization, but not too much. Basically, there were two kinds of people in their 80s. There were people who were these amazing, very youthful people. Really alive, really kind of remarkable. There were not so many of them. But the other kind are people who are absolutely full of resentment. Shutdownness and resentment and closedness And in a way that there's like sweet fruit or bitter fruit, and obviously there's, you know, gradations in between that. There's not that quite black and white, but in a sense that's kind of what happens. And if we keep revisiting winter, the things that need to die die. If we try and keep everything alive, everything gets choked. So part of this work, part of what we're looking at, is the experience of death as a positive process. That said, of course, it never feels positive. The death of people we love or the death of things we like never feels positive when it's happening. How could it? Now, if we go right back to the beginnings of Western civilization, if we go back really pretty much into the Bronze Age, say about 500 years before Christ, 600 years, pretty much the same time as the Buddha's around, the beginnings of Western philosophy, to the pre-Socratic philosophers. We need to go back to them, because if we're looking, if we want to really look at, well, how do we have the attitudes that we have, and how do we relate to these things? They really go back that far. And if we go back to, in particular, to a man called Parmenides. Parmenides of Elea. I first came across Parmenides of Elea studying philosophy in university when I was very young. And Parmenides is described as the father of logic. He is described as the person who really started to help people and help Greek philosophy determine what is false and what is true. So he's seen as one of the great foundations, the foundation stones around which from which logic and reason are built upon. And remember the whole course on him, and then and his successors, and you look at people like Plato and then Aristotle, and what is being described is a chain of reasoning, a way of separating ourselves from superstition and fantasy, and discovering the good, the true, and the beautiful. What also you see developed in that chain, which continues and continues down to our day, is a movement away from the earth, away from the body, away from things that cannot be defined. And in Plato's writings, in particular, you find the idea that that there is a purer world behind the world that we're in, where you find the archetypes of things, the essences of things, that are in some ways purer than the embodied, living, messy experience that we find ourselves in. And that direction is up. So we go up into the sky. We go up to the place where heaven is. And in a way, it's one of the very early splits that we discover, where the body, the earth, femininity, women, are seen as inferior to masculinity, to reason, to the spiritual. If we look at social customs in early Athens, for example, this is a very, very patriarchal society, polytheistic, but women had almost no rights at all in Athens. They were kept locked up, mostly. The image of the Athens as the cradle of democracy and all these good things, none of that applied to women. When you look at Athenian society, you look at that this time of Plato, Socrates, what you have is a real, except in one place in Plato, in the Symposium, where he talks about the priestess teacher Diotima, who is the teacher of Socrates, who is a woman. So there is some aspects of womanhood, sacred womanhood, that's allowed in particular contexts. But mostly the women are kept behind, looking after the family, locked up just like you would in any fantasy of an Eastern harem. So you think about Turkish Ottoman harems, in a way it's interesting, Greek Turkish thing. The Greeks are often seen as the antithesis of that kind of Eastern model of subservience, and actually Romans are much better about sexual equality between males and females. Still a patriarchal society, but they're much better than the Athenians. Spartans, on the other hand, are the Greek city-state that isn't the one that's considered cultured and is considered almost fascistic in its ideas, have real equality between men and women. Things are quite different from the way they appear. Now, if we go back to Parmenides, however, And if you really look at who Parmenides is, what actually, what you might expect from the father of logic is a logical treatise that explains that, you know, much in the way that you find later in Plato and Aristotle. Actually, what you have is a poem. He wrote a poem. And the poem of Parmenides begins with a vision. And it begins with the with a goddess talking to him, telling him a path that he must follow. And she begins with a very particular word. She's a young man. She's dressing young. The word is kouros. Now, if you know anything about Greek sculpture, Greek, when you look at archaic Greek sculpture, there are these figures with huge eyes, and their sides are very stiff. Their arms are by their side. They're called kouroi. They are the masculine figures. But they're these very stiff, archaic thing. We're not with the kind of the more fluid, you know, later Greek thing. This is very early. And the kouroi are the sons of the mother. They are these figures that dive into the deep places of the mother. They are her servants and her messengers. They later are like angels. They are the angeli. They are the archaic version of angels. And what the goddess does in calling him Kouros is to name him as her messenger, as her servant. Now, the beginning of his journey, this poem, they talk about it, philosophers will talk about it as the prelude. And they dismiss it because they found a way to dismiss it because they regard it as how it's regarded is, oh, well, he had to say all that because these are the religious customs of the time. It's just the prelude. But actually the prelude is in his poem is crucial. Because what is this described is a journey into depth. The young man is taken into the chariot of the goddess, led by the daughters of the sun. And he's told that he has to surrender himself to the guidance of the daughters of the sun and to the mares that drive it. So it's not stallions who are drawing the chariot, it's mares. And they take him into the place, into the house of night, where the sun goes to rest. And at that place, he comes to a threshold where there are these two great doors. In a way, they are the doors into the underworld. And there's a lot of description about these doors that represent the opposites of life. So and guarding the doors is the goddess Themis, who in the ancient world is the goddess of justice and truth. And the daughters of the sun, with sweet and cunning words, persuade the goddess Themis to open the doors into Tartarus, into the underworld, into the place where the sun goes to sleep at night. Now, the place where the sun goes to sleep is the deep place, is the place of darkness, is the place where the sun goes to renew itself. It's also became known as the place where you find the sun at midnight, because it's where the sun goes to sleep every night. Now, the sun at midnight in the mystery traditions of later Greece and Rome is the symbol. But the person who has seen the sun at midnight is the person who has gone into the deep place, has gone into death and renewal. And can put the opposites of life and death together, who is initiate of the mystery schools. So what Parmenides is showing and telling us in these stories is that he is a servant of the goddess, he is the kouros, who knows, who has gone into the house of the sun at midnight. He is not actually a rationalist. He is somebody who is an initiate of the ancient mysteries of the goddess and a servant of the goddess. He is an angelos, a messenger of the goddess. And what happens to him as he goes into the house of midnight, the goddess takes him to a place, this is where the philosophers get interested, he comes to a crossroads. And the got the goddess, and he comes to a nameless goddess. Now the goddess there is not named, but if you were an ancient Greek reading that, you would know that what is meant to be, with the goddess who is not named is the goddess of death, is the goddess Persephone. This is the death goddess who sits in the deep place where everything dies and everything comes back to life. And he's at a crossroads with her. Now later in Greek, greater in Neoplatonic tradition, we find the goddess Hecate, who is the goddess of the crossroads. She's a later figure. This is the earlier figure, the crossroads goddess Persephone. And in the poem, the poem talks about what is. I will tell you about what is true and what is not true. And this is the place where logicians say, "Oh, this is where he's now demonstrating to us how to tell the difference between what is true and not true." And he has a choice of three paths. One is the path of not truth. One is the two-headed path where you just run back and forth. And the third path is the path of truth, the path of what can be proven. And it's on, and then there's, I won't go into all the details of the poem, it's quite long, but what logicians do with that experience is that they describe it as him laying out a logical system of thought. So that at each time when you're trying to work out whether something's true or not, what you have to do is notice you're at a crossroads, notice and determine by reasoning what is false and what is true. And in that process you have a certain amount of double-headedness where you're running back and forth between things. But what actually, that isn't really what happens in the poem. What the goddess shows him in the poem is basically, she says, very simply, everything is true. She says, talks about the path which they call the path of falsity. This is a path that no one can take. So what is not true? There is no such path. She removes that path. She also says, well, there's also the double-headed path where you're just running around. And you can stay there, but in that path you don't move forward. The only path is the way forward. And the only way forward is to believe, is to trust your experience that everything is true. Whatever you experience is true. Your journey is a true journey. Doesn't mean your interpretation of it is true, but it means that everything you experience is true. And in fact, one of the great problems at the root of Western philosophy, in a way, is this attempt to logically determine, as a process of thought, what is true or false about things that you cannot determine whether they are true or false. If you're adding up a sum in arithmetic, in simple arithmetic, you can determine whether you're right or not, because you follow a process, and the process, even the process of mathematics, because when you make mistakes in mathematics, it's because you're not following the process of it. What the goddess is saying, any process that is followed, any true road that is followed, any road that is followed is a true road. How you interpret that thing is a slightly different matter. Now, the problem that we have, the problem that Western philosophy has in respect of this, is it founds itself on a mistake. Because what Parmenides is saying, what we know about Parmenides gives more credence to this. Because he is a priest, He is the priest of Apollo Uliades. Uliades means the god who kills and makes alive again. Now we're with not the later Apollo here, we're with the ancient Apollo, sometimes called the wolfish Apollo, or the Hyperborean Apollo, the Apollo from the north wind. The Apollo from the House of Darkness, whose twin sister is Artemis. And at one level, one of the cult animals connected with Artemis and Apollo is the bear. They are the twin bears. He's the male bear, she's the she-bear. The other title that was, there are two other titles given to the priests of Apollo Uliades. They are called Iatromantis, healer prophet. They're also called Phylakis. Phylakis means lord of the lair. So if you had a problem in those times, you would go to the healer priest, lord of the lair, and the healer priest would not sit down with you and counsel you and work out what is true or what is false about your experience, what is true or false about your thinking. He would take you into the lair. And the lair is the temple, and in the temple there are these sleeping cells, which are incubation chambers, where you would dream, where you would be invited to sleep and dream and see what the god says to you, see what the god and the god's mother says to you. You would be encouraged to go down and in. You'd follow the path of the bear into the dreaming place. You would be encouraged to trust your experience, not to dismiss it, to stay with it. The whole point of Parmenides' poem is you stay with the experience. Because if you don't stay with the experience, you end up with two other experiences. You end up in the place of which nothing can be said, the place of where you disconnect from your experience and you're in a void. Or you're in the twin-headed place, which is the place of ambivalence, where you just run round and round and exhaust yourself. So the choice at the choice point, when you're travelling inside yourself, is whether to continue with your experience, to receive it and to keep receiving it and therefore to keep going deeply with it, or to go into the void place where nothing happens, or to, through ambivalence, to run round and round repetitively, exhausting yourself. But if you do go into the deeper place, you're going into the house of the sun at midnight, the light that is found in darkness, the illumination that comes to you eventually comes firstly through deeper darkness, through the letting go of the known and the movement towards the unknown. To the place of stripping away what is known and allowing yourself to be led by the mares, by the goddess, by the mysterious unfolding path that creates itself step by step in front of us. In order so that we die and are made alive again. Now, one of the few fragments we have of Parmenides is he talks about his own teacher who taught him this way. And what he says he learned from his teacher is something he calls Hesius, which means stillness. I learned to be still. I learned silence. He learned to be silent, he learned to go into the deep place. He learned to follow the path of the bear, and he learned to trust his experience. Parmenides was also a judge and a lawgiver in Ilia. And to try and get the difference between this archaic society and our own, you'd have to imagine going to the High Court, and you put out your issue to the judge. And the judge, instead of weighing up legal arguments, says, okay, I'm going to go off to the temple of Apollo, and I'm going to dream my judgment. And then, instead of coming out with the judgment which he justifies, the judge comes back and says, I find, you know, this is my judgment. The god or the goddess has told me this. Probably makes them sound a bit mad. But actually, that, in a way, that is the world of Ilia. This is the world of Parmenides. The world then that later gets split. And it's not to denigrate reason, but it's to see that there are places where reason doesn't work. Reason is its own process. But if you apply rational thought to the places that are deeper than rationality, something gets very, very confused. It's been fascinating for me when, however long it was, 15 years ago, I rediscovered Parmenides, because I'd studied him in university, and I realized I must have never read it. I did read it, but I've read it through the eyes of my teachers and through the eyes of explanations about Parmenides, because actually when I just read it again, I just thought, well, it doesn't make any sense. He's not saying what's attributed to him. The poem itself is quite unequivocal in lots of ways. It is a description of a vision, and it's a description of and the view of the universe. He goes later to describe the view of the universe, where he says the universe is one sphere, where everything is connected, and underneath everything, he says, there is just stillness. There is a deep stillness underneath everything. And everything above it is this lovely word, the exchange of bright colour. So everything is in movement. Underneath it, everything is still. But what's going on in movement is the exchange of bright colour. And in a way, it's kind of interesting, because these images, this image of the Kouros and the mother, this image of the descent into the depths, this image of the path of the bear even, we find echoing down through Western culture. Classically, in Christianity, I mean, Christ, in a way, you could say, is the Kouros of Mary. If we look at that ancient Greek world, ancient Greek, archaic Greek, looking at images, looking at icons of Christ and Mary, looking at Pieta images, or looking at Christ and the Madonna and Child images, icons you get, they would understand that. But they wouldn't understand it in the way that we think of it, to say, oh, there's a Kouros with the mother. The young man and the mother, Mary and Jesus. It's interesting, isn't it? In such a patriarchal system, Joseph is almost invisible. Because actually what you have is a very ancient image repeating itself of the son and the mother. Welsh tradition, you find it again as Mabon, son of Modron. So the Mabinogion is based around this myth of the son who is the son of the mother. And this is the Mabinogion's medieval book, but actually it's picking up again on very, very ancient themes. Now, our problem, we'll come back to the break room for lunch, but the problem that we face when we look at these issues, we look at the poems, we look at the stories, we look at our own inner experience, is that we face the part of ourselves that makes the same error as the early Greek philosophers. Because the thing above all that pulls us out of our imaginative experience is that there's the wish to know whether it's true or not, and the ambivalence that kicks in at the choice point. So in a certain sense, we repeat, and are bound to, because we're taught with it. It's our culture is imbued, deeply imbued, with this split that doesn't trust the intuition, that doesn't trust the imagination, that doesn't trust embodiment, because the good is up there somewhere. Right, so in a Christianity, although it comes out of a Jewish background originally, is massively influenced by Greek tradition. So the Gospels are written in Greek, and you have that Neoplatonic cosmology adopted by the early Christian teachers, because they come out of that world, the Romano-Greek world, and the good is above. It's in heaven. You know, Christ ascends to heaven. You know, conventionally we ask kids about, you know, where's God? God's up there. Where do you go? And you know, you go up there. And that's very, very different. It's very different from the Welsh, the Welsh images, the early Greek images, which are about the holiness of inside and below. So the central process that is being described in the Parmenides poem is we could put it in different words, it is the descent into Anuven, the descent into the very deep place. The place where you find the sun at midnight, place where you die and are made alive again. The place where opposites come together. Not the place where you leave behind the messiness and go into an ethereal place. I'll come back to this afternoon a bit, because there's quite a lot to say about it, but there's just two interesting parallels going on. One very interesting parallel going on this at the same time, which is the life of the Buddha. A similar time to Parmenides, who, now, the thing that you see in the life of the Buddha, he's, the myth of the Buddha is all about how can I deal with old age, suffering and death? What's the solution to that? And he spends the early part of his life trying to get away from it all. He leaves his family, first of all, so he gets rid of that, but he sneaks out from the, you know, he's got a baby son, and he sneaks out of the palace and runs away from them. He then gets involved in lots of meditation things where he's trying to get into more profound states of stillness. Eventually tries to not eat. Got these powerful images of the skeleton Buddha surviving on a grain of rice a day. And what happens to him at that point is a point of real depression, because he finds he reaches a barrier in all his different ways to get away from the world. He reaches a barrier he can't get past. He cannot become independent of the world. So he can go into great states of stillness where he doesn't feel anything. But if he stops doing the meditation, he starts to feel things again. He starts to be back in the mess. He can live on almost, his body can live on one grain of rice a day, but he still needs the grain of rice a day. And so there's a very powerful image of him sitting down at a riverbank, really depressed, his great project at an end. And then a story, which you only find now in things called the Jakarta stories, which was actually edited out of the earlier canon. He has an encounter with a young woman at the riverbank who gives him rice milk, and who feeds him in a sense, and as a result of that, he has a very strong memory of sitting under the rose apple tree, being at one with the rose apple tree. And from that experience, he experiences the sense of being able to sit in the body with the world, which leads him to sit underneath the Bodhi tree, accepting everything that happens to him. He sits under the Bodhi tree, he's challenged by Mara, who's the tempter figure. And his way of dealing with Mara is not to chase him away or to kill him. He has to keep saying, I know you, Mara. And that knowing is almost, it's the sexual knowing, it's the physical knowing. I know you, you are part of me. So he sits there, including the whole of the world, but not moving from his spot, but trusting everything that happens to him, knowing everything that's happening to him, making nothing alien, bringing all the opposites together. And he sits under this amazing kind of tree. And there is a great moment after his enlightenment where people are, well, how do you know you're enlightened? He touches the earth, and the earth mother confirms him as the Buddha. He is a Kuros. He is the messenger of the mother. And very, very strangely, we find these themes in all. We find them actually the same theme in a thing called the 16th century ballad called the Ballad of Thomas the Rhymer, where Thomas the Rhymer is taken on a horse, taken into the fairyland, and sits under an apple tree, not the rose apple tree, but an apple tree, and is shown a choice of three ways, and is taken into the middle way, the way that is the mysterious way over the hill, into the unknown. I'll come back to this more, and I'll apply it to the kind of poems and things that we're looking at. But what I wanted to leave you with this morning is this idea that something very profoundly has gone wrong in the whole directionality of Western civilization. Because what happened as a result of the deliberate misinterpretation of Parmenides, and the development of Platonic philosophy, and then even Aristotelian philosophy, which in an odd way was an attempt to try and undo the idealism of the Platonic way. It has, out of that culture has come a distortion that is relevant to us now, not just because it's in our culture, but because it's in us. That takes us into the place of doubting our own mysterious experience. That takes us away from ourselves. And takes us away from the experience of embodiment. And the power of our imaginative powers. So for example, if you go inside and you have a memory of the past that feels, solid memory, that, of course, is real and important and needs attention. If you go inside yourself and you experience an unicorn, the challenge is, can you give the unicorn the same weight that you give the memory of something known in your childhood or known or something I experienced last week? Can I treat that equally? Can I sit like the Buddha and say, I know you, unicorn. I acknowledge you. I listen to you. I let you into my heart. And then the question is, what happens when we do? What happens when we don't do that? What happens in the ambivalent place? So these moments, these crossroad moments, are the moments we keep coming to in this work. And then the final thing to say for this morning is that the point of the poem, and the reason why we're going to study this poem for 2 years, is because it holds a lot of these contradictions inside it. And it oddly has its own relationship even to the work of Parmenides. Because the poem keeps repeating, we go with Arthur, gan Arthur in Welsh. So if we go with Arthur, the derivation of the word Arthur in Welsh, you could say, means bear man, the man who is a bear. So we go with the bear. And in a way, it's that ancient path of the bear into the depths that Parmenides is explaining in his terms, that is very similar, slightly different words, slightly different culture, slightly different time, but very similar process that is being described in the poem. When we go into the deep place, we go with the bear man. And then lots of things happen to us as we let ourselves do that. And Arthur is this very mysterious figure whom we think we know, and of course not, there's lots of unknown things about Arthur. The once and future king. It's this primordial figure, the once who comes again, who sleeps in Avalon. Who creates the perfect kingdom that all falls apart. Who is the perfect king who kills his son, who tries to kill him, but who is taken by the mothers into the deep place. So we'll come back to this and come back to Arthur this afternoon. So have a nice lunch. So it's 1:45 now, so we come back at 1:15.